Encyclical OFPOPE John 23 ONMAY 15, 1961. To his venerable brethren the patriarchs, primates, archbishops, bishops, and all other local ordinaries, that are at peace, and in communion with the Apostolic See, and to the clergy and faithful of the entire Catholic world. Venerable brethren and dearest sons, health and apostolic benediction. Mother and teacher of all nations, such is the Catholic Church in the mind of her founder, Jesus Christ, to hold the world in an embrace of love, that men, in every age, should find in her their own completeness and higher order of living, and their ultimate salvation. She is the pillar and ground of the truth one. To her was entrusted by her holy founder the twofold task of giving life to her children, and of teaching the men, guiding them, both as individuals and as nations, with maternal care. Great is their dignity, a dignity which she has always guarded most zealously, and held in the highest esteem. 2. Christianity is the meeting point of earth and heaven. It lays claim to the whole man, body, and soul, intellect and will, inducing him to raise his mind above the changing conditions of this earthly existence, and reach upwards for the eternal life of heaven, where one day he will find his unfailing happiness and peace. 3. Hence, though the Church's first care must be for souls, how she can sanctify them, and make them share in the gifts of heaven, she concerns herself too with the exigencies of man's daily life, with his livelihood and education, and his general temporal welfare and prosperity. For in all this she is but giving effect to those principles which Christ himself established in the Church he founded, when he said, I'm the way, and the truth, and the life. 2. I'm the light of the world. 3. It was doubtless man's eternal salvation that was uppermost in his mind, but he showed his concern for the material welfare of his people when, seeing the hungry crowd of his followers, he was moved to exclaim, I have compassion on the multitude. 4. And these were no empty words of our divine Redeemer. Time and again he proved them by his actions, as when he miraculously multiplied bread, to alleviate the hunger of the crowds. 5. Bread it was for the body, but it was intended also, to foreshadow that other bread, that heavenly food of the soul, which he was to give them on the night before he suffered. 6. Small wonder, then, that the Catholic Church, in imitation of Christ, and in fulfillment of his commandment, relies not merely upon her teaching to hold aloft the torch of charity, but also upon her own widespread example. This has been her course now for nigh on 2,000 years, from the early ministrations of her deacons right down to the present time. It is a charity which combines the precepts and practice of mutual love. It holds fast to the twofold aspect of Christ's command to give, and summarizes the whole of the Church's social teaching and activity. 7. An outstanding instance of this social teaching and action carried on by the Church throughout the ages is undoubtedly that magnificent encyclical on the Christianizing of the conditions of the working classes, Rerum Novarum, published 70 years ago by our predecessor, Leo XIII. 8. Seldom have the words of a pontiff met with such universal acclaim. In the weight and scope of his arguments, and in the forcefulness of their expression, Pope Leo XIII can have but few rivals. Beyond any shadow of doubt, his directives and appeals have established for themselves a position of such high importance, that they will never, surely, sink into oblivion. They opened out new horizons for the activity of the universal Church, and the Supreme Shepherd, by giving expression to the hardships and sufferings and aspirations of the lowly and oppressed, made himself the champion and restorer of their rights. 9. The impact of this remarkable encyclical is still with us even today, so many years after it was written. It is discernible in the writings of the popes who succeeded Pope Leo. In their social and economic teaching they have frequent recourse to the Leonine encyclical, either to draw inspiration from it, and clarify its application, or to find in it a stimulus to Catholic action. It is discernible too in the subsequent legislation of a number of states. What further proof need we of the permanent validity of the solidly grounded principles practical directives and fatherly appeals contained in this masterly encyclical. It also suggests new and vital criteria by which men can judge the magnitude of the social question as it presents itself today, and decide on the course of action they must take. 10. Leo XIII spoke in a time of social and economic upheaval, of heightening tensions and actual revolt. Against this dark background, the brilliance of his teaching stands out in clear relief. 11. As is well known, the outlook that prevailed on economic matters was for the most part a purely naturalistic one, which denied any correlation between economics and morality. Personal gain was considered the only valid motive for economic activity. In business, the main operative principle was that of free and unrestricted competition. Interest on capital, prices, whether of goods or of services, profits, and wages, were to be determined by the purely mechanical application of the laws of the marketplace. Every precaution was to be taken to prevent the civil authority from intervening in any way in economic matters. The status of trade unions varied in different countries. They were either forbidden, tolerated, or recognized as having private legal personality only. 12. In an economic world of this character, it was the might of the strongest which not only arrogated to itself the force of law, but also dominated the ordinary business relationships between individuals, and thereby undermined the whole economic structure. 13. Enormous riches accumulated in the hands of a few, while large numbers of working men found themselves in conditions of ever-increasing hardship. Wages were insufficient even to the point of reaching starvation level, and working conditions were often of such a nature as to be injurious alike to health, morality and religious faith. Especially inhuman were the working conditions to which women and children were sometimes subjected. There was also the constant specter of unemployment and the progressive disruption of family life. 14. The natural consequence of all this was a spirit of indignation and open protest on the part of the working men, and the widespread tendency to subscribe to extremist theories far worse in their effects than the evils they purported to remedy. 15. It was at such a time and under pressure of such circumstances as these that Leo XIII wrote his social encyclical, Rerum Novarum, based on the needs of human nature itself, and animated by the principles and spirit of the gospel. His message, not unnaturally, aroused opposition in some quarters, but was received by the majority of people with the greatest admiration and enthusiasm. It was not, of course, the first occasion on which the Apostolic See had come out strongly in defense of the earthly interests of the poor. Indeed, Leo himself had made other pronouncements which in a sense had prepared the way for his encyclical. But here for the first time was a complete synthesis of social principles, formulated with such historical insight as to be of permanent value to Christendom. It is rightly regarded as a compendium of Catholic social and economic teaching. 16. In this, Leo XIII showed us complete mastery of the situation. There were those who presumed to accuse the Church of taking no interest in social matters other than to preach resignation to the poor and generosity to the rich. But Leo XIII had no hesitation in proclaiming and defending the legitimate rights of the workers. As he said at the beginning of his exposition of the principles and precepts of the Church in social matters, "We approach the subject with confidence, and in the exercise of the rights which manifestly appertain to us, for no practical solution of this question will be found apart from the Council of Religion, and of the Church." 6:17. You know well enough, venerable brethren, the basic economic and social principles for the reconstruction of human society enunciated so clearly and authoritatively by this great Pope. 18. They concern first of all the question of work, which must be regarded not merely as a commodity, but as a specifically human activity. In the majority of cases, a man's work is his sole means of livelihood. Its remuneration, therefore, cannot be made to depend on the state of the market. It must be determined by the laws of justice and equity. Any other procedure would be a clear violation of justice, even supposing the contract of work to have been freely entered into by both parties. 19. Secondly, private ownership of property, including that of productive goods, is a natural right which the state cannot suppress, but it naturally entails a social obligation as well. It is a right which must be exercised not only for one's own personal benefit, but also for the benefit of others. 20. As for the state, its whole raison d'etre is the realization of the common good in the temporal order. It cannot, therefore, hold aloof from economic matters. On the contrary, it must do all in its power to promote the production of a sufficient supply of material goods, the use of which is necessary for the practice of virtue. 7. It is also the duty to protect the rights of all its people, and particularly of its weaker members, the workers, women and children. It can never be right for the state to shirk its obligation of working actively for the betterment of the condition of the workingman. 21. It is furthermore the duty of the state to ensure that terms of employment are regulated in accordance with justice and equity, and to safeguard the human dignity of workers by making sure that they are not required to work in an environment which may prove harmful to their material and spiritual interests. It was for this reason that the Leonine encyclical enunciated those general principles of rightness and equity which have been assimilated into the social legislation of many a modern state, and which, as Pope Pius XI declared in the encyclical Quadragesimo Anno, 8, have made no small contribution to the rise and development of that new branch of jurisprudence called labor law. 22. Pope Leo XIII also defended the worker's natural right to enter into association with his fellows. Such associations may consist either of workers alone, or of workers and employers, and should be structured in a way best calculated to safeguard the workers' legitimate professional interest. And it is the natural right of the workers to work without hindrance, freely, and on their own initiative within these associations for the achievement of these ends. 23. Finally, both workers and employers should regulate their mutual relations in accordance with the principle of human solidarity and Christian brotherhood. Unrestricted competition in the liberal sense and the Marxist creed of class warfare are clearly contrary to Christian teaching and the nature of man. 24. These, venerable brethren, are the basic principles upon which a genuine social and economic order must be built. 25. The response of good Catholics to this appeal and the enterprise they showed in reducing these principles into practice is hardly surprising. But others too, men of goodwill from every nation in the world, were impelled, under pressure of human necessity, to pursue the same course. 26. Hence, the Leonine encyclical is rightly regarded, even today, as the Magna Charta 9, of social and economic reconstruction. 27. 40 years after the appearance of this magnificent summary of Christian social principles, our predecessor, Pius XI, published his own encyclical, Quadragesimo Anno 10. 28. In it the Supreme Pontiff confirmed the right and duty of the Catholic Church to work for an equitable solution of the many pressing problems weighing upon human society, and calling for a joint effort by all the people. He reiterated the principles of the Leonine encyclical, and stressed those directives which were applicable to modern conditions. In addition, he took the opportunity not only to clarify certain points of this teaching which had given rise to difficulties even in the minds of Catholics, but also to reformulate Christian social thought in the light of changed conditions. 29. The difficulties referred to principally concerned the Catholics' attitude to private property, the wage system, and moderate socialism. 30. With regard to private property, our predecessor reaffirmed its origin in natural law, and enlarged upon its social aspect and the obligations of ownership. 31. As for the wage system, while rejecting the view that it is unjust of its very nature, he condemned the inhuman and unjust way in which is it so often implemented, and specified the terms and conditions to be observed if justice and equity are not to be violated. 32. In this connection, as our predecessor clearly points out, it is advisable in the present circumstances that the wage contract be somewhat modified by applying to it elements taken from the contract of partnership, so that wage earners and other employees participate in the ownership or the management, or in some way share in the profits. 11. 33. Of special doctrinal and practical importance is his affirmation that, If the social and individual character of work be overlooked, it can be neither justly valued nor equitably recompensed. 12. In determining wages, therefore, justice demands that account be taken not only of the needs of the individual workers and their families, but also of the financial state of the business concern for which they work and of the economic welfare of the whole people. 1334. Pope Pius XI further emphasized the fundamental opposition between communism and Christianity, and made it clear that no Catholic could subscribe even to moderate socialism. The reason is that socialism is founded on a doctrine of human society which is bounded by time and takes no account of any objective other than that of material well-being. Since, therefore, it proposes a form of social organization which aims solely at production, it places too severe restraint on human liberty, at the same time flouting the true notion of social authority. 35. Pius XI was not unaware of the fact that in the 40 years that had supervened since the publication of the Leonine encyclical the historical scene had altered considerably. It was clear, for example, that unregulated competition had succumbed to its own inherent tendencies to the point of practically destroying itself. It had given rise to a great accumulation of wealth, and, in the process, concentrated a despotic economic power in the hands of a few, who for the most part are not the owners, but only the trustees and directors have invested funds, which they administer at their own good pleasure. 1436. Hence, as the Pope remarks so discerningly, economic domination has taken the place of the open market. Unbridled ambition for domination has succeeded the desire for gain. The whole economic regime has become hard, cruel, and relentless in frightful measure. 15. As a consequence, even the public authority was becoming the tool of plutocracy, which was thus gaining a stranglehold on the entire world. 37. Pius XI saw the re-establishment of the economic world within the framework of the moral order and the subordination of individual and group interests to the interest of the common good as the principal remedies for these evils. This, he taught, necessitated an orderly reconstruction of society, with the establishment of economic and vocational bodies which would be autonomous and independent of the state. Public authority should resume its duty of promoting the common good of all. Finally, there should be cooperation on a world scale for the economic welfare of all nations. 38. Thus Pius XI's teaching in this encyclical can be summed up under two heads. First, he taught what the supreme criterion in economic matters ought not to be. It must not be the special interests of individuals or groups, nor unregulated competition, economic despotism, national prestige or imperialism, nor any other aim of this sort. 39. On the contrary, all forms of economic enterprise must be governed by the principles of social justice and charity. 40. The second point which we consider basic in the encyclical is his teaching that man's aim must be to achieve in social justice a national and international juridical order, with its network of public and private institutions, in which all economic activity can be conducted not merely for private gain, but also in the interests of the common good. 41. For all that he did to render more precise the Christian definition of social rights and duties, no small recognition is due to our late predecessor, Pius XII. On Pentecost Sunday, June 1, 1941, he broadcast his message, to call to the attention of the Catholic world a memory worthy of being written in letters of gold on the Church's calendar, the 50th anniversary of the publication of the epoch-making social encyclical of Leo XIII, Rerum Novarum, 16, and, to render to Almighty God from the bottom of our heart our humble thanks for the gift which he bestowed on the Church in that encyclical of his vicar on earth, and to praise him for the life-giving breath of the Spirit which through it, in ever-growing measure from that time on, has blown on all mankind. 1742. In that broadcast message the great pontiff claimed for the Church the indisputable competence to decide whether the bases of a given social system are in accord with the unchangeable order which God our Creator and Redeemer has shown us through the natural law in Revelation 18, He confirmed the perennial validity and inexhaustible worth of the teaching of Rerum Novarum, and took occasion to give some further directive moral principles on three fundamental values of social and economic life. These three fundamental values, which are closely connected one with the other, mutually complementary and dependent, are the use of material goods, work, and the family. 1943. Concerning the use of material goods, our predecessor declared that the right of every man to use these for his own sustenance is prior to every other economic right, even that of private property. The right to the private possession of material goods is admittedly a natural one. Nevertheless, in the objective order established by God, the right to property cannot stand in the way of the axiomatic principle that the goods which were created by God for all men should flow to all alike, according to the principles of justice and charity. 2044. On the subject of work, Pius XII repeated the teaching of the Leonine encyclical, maintaining that a man's work is at once his duty and his right. It is for individuals, therefore, to regulate their mutual relations where their work is concerned. If they cannot do so, or will not do so, then, and only then, does it fall back on the state to intervene in the division and distribution of work, and this must be according to the form and measure that the common good properly understood demands. 2145. In dealing with the family, the Supreme Pontiff affirmed that the private ownership of material goods has a great part to play in promoting the welfare of family life. It secures for the father of a family the healthy liberty he needs in order to fulfill the duties assigned him by the Creator regarding the physical, spiritual and religious welfare of the family. 22. It is in this that the right of families to migrate is rooted. And so our predecessor, in speaking of migration, admonished both parties involved, namely the country of departure and the country receiving the newcomers, to seek always to eliminate as far as possible all obstacles to the birth and growth of real confidence. 23. Between the nations. In this way both will contribute to, and share in, the increased welfare of man and the progress of culture. 46. But in the 20 years which have elapsed since the changing economic climate noted at that time by Pius XII, the economic scene has undergone a radical transformation, both in the internal structure of the various states, and in their relations with one another. 47. In the field of science, technology, and economics we have the discovery of nuclear energy, and its application first to the purposes of war and later, increasingly, to peaceful ends, the practically limitless possibilities of chemistry in the production of synthetic materials, the growth of automation in industry and public services, the modernization of agriculture, the easing of communications, especially by radio and television, faster transportation, and the initial conquest of interplanetary space. 48. In the social field we have the development of social insurance, and, in the more economically advanced communities, the introduction of social security systems. Men in labor unions are showing a more responsible awareness of the major social and economic problems. There is a progressive improvement in basic education, a wider distribution of essential commodities, greater opportunities for advancement in industry and the consequent breaking down of class barriers, and a keener interest in world affairs shown by people of average education. At the same time, however, this assessment of the increased efficiency of social and economic systems in a growing number of communities serves also to bring to light certain glaring discrepancies. There is, in the first place, a progressive lack of balance between agriculture on the one hand, and industry and public services on the other. Secondly, there are areas of varying economic prosperity within the same political communities. Finally, to take a world view, one observes a marked disparity in the economic wealth possessed by different countries. 49. To turn to the political field, We observe many changes in a number of countries. All classes of citizens are taking a part in public life, and public authorities are injecting themselves more each day into social and economic matters. We are witnessing the breakaway from colonialism and the attainment of political independence by the peoples of Asia and Africa. Drawn together by their common needs, nations are becoming daily more interdependent. There is, moreover, an ever-extending network of societies and organizations which set their sights beyond the aims and interests of individual countries, and concentrate on the economic, social, cultural and political welfare of all nations throughout the world. 50. As we pass all this in review, we are aware of our responsibility to take out this torch which our great predecessors lighted, and hand it on with undiminished flame. It is a torch to lighten the pathways of all who would seek appropriate solutions to the many social problems of our times. Our purpose, therefore, is not merely to commemorate in a fitting manner the Leonine encyclical, but also to confirm and make more specific the teaching of our predecessors, and to determine clearly the mind of the Church on the new and important problems of the day. 51. It should be stated at the outset that in the economic order, first place must be given to the personal initiative of private citizens working either as individuals, or in association with each other in various ways for the furtherance of common interests. 52. But, for reasons explained by our predecessors, the civil power must also have a hand in the economy. It has to promote production in a way best calculated to achieve social progress and the well-being of all citizens. 53. And in this work of directing, stimulating, coordinating, supplying, and integrating, its guiding principle must be the principle of subsidiary function, formulated by Buys 11 in Quadragesimo Anno, 24. This is a fundamental principle of social philosophy, unshaken and unchangeable. Just as it is wrong to withdraw from the individual and commit to a community what private enterprise and industry can accomplish, so too it is an injustice, a grave evil and a disturbance of right order, for a larger and higher association to arrogate to itself functions which can be performed efficiently by smaller and lower societies. Of its very nature, the true aim of all social activity should be to help members of the social body, but never to destroy or absorb them. 25. 54. The present advance in scientific knowledge and productive technology clearly puts it within the power of the public authority to a much greater degree than ever before to reduce imbalances which may exist between different branches of the economy, or between different regions within the same country, or even between the different peoples of the world. It also puts into the hands of public authority a greater means for limiting fluctuations in the economy, and for providing effective measures to prevent the recurrence of mass unemployment. Hence the insistent demands on those in authority, since they are responsible for the common good, to increase the degree and scope of their activities in the economic sphere, and to devise ways and means and set the necessary machinery in motion for the attainment of this end. 55. But however extensive and far-reaching the influence of the state on the economy may be, it must never be exerted to the extent of depriving the individual citizen of his freedom of action. It must rather augment his freedom, while effectively guaranteeing the protection of his essential personal rights. Among these is a man's right and duty to be primarily responsible for his own upkeep and bed of his family. Hence every economic system must permit and facilitate the free development of productive activity. 56. Moreover, as history itself testifies with ever-increasing clarity, there can be no such thing as a well-ordered and prosperous society unless individual citizens and the state cooperate in the economy. Both sides must work together in harmony, and their respective efforts must be proportioned to the needs of the common good in the prevailing circumstances and conditions of human life. 57. Experience has shown that where personal initiative is lacking, political tyranny ensues, and, in addition, economic stagnation in the production of a wide range of consumer goods and of services of the material and spiritual order, those, namely, which are in a great measure dependent upon the exercise and stimulus of individual creative talent. 58. Where, on the other hand, the good offices of the state are lacking, or a deficient incurable disorder ensues, in particular, the unscrupulous exploitation of the weak by the strong. For men of this stamp are always in evidence, and, like cockle among the wheat, thrive in every land. 59. Certainly one of the principal characteristics which seem to be typical of our age is an increase in social relationships, in those mutual ties, that is, which grow daily more numerous, and which have led to the introduction of many and varied forms of associations in the lives and activities of citizens, and to their acceptance within our legal framework. Scientific and technical progress, greater productive efficiency and a higher standard of living, are among the many present-day factors which would seem to have contributed to this trend. 60. This development in the social life of man is at once a symptom and a cause of the growing intervention of the state, even in matters which are of intimate concern to the individual, hence of great importance, and not devoid of risk. We might cite as examples such matters as health and education, the choice of a career, and the care and rehabilitation of the physically and mentally handicapped. It is also partly the result, partly the expression of a natural, well-nigh irresistible urge in man, to combine with his fellows for the attainment of aims and objectives which are beyond the means or the capabilities of single individuals. In recent times, this tendency has given rise to the formation everywhere of both national and international movements, associations, and institutions with economic, cultural, social, sporting, recreational, professional and political ends. 61. Clearly, this sort of development in social relationships brings many advantages in its train. It makes it possible for the individual to exercise many of his personal rights, especially those which we call economic and social, and which pertain to the necessities of life, health care, education on a more extensive and improved basis, a more thorough professional training, housing, work, and suitable leisure and recreation. Furthermore, the progressive perfection of modern methods of thought diffusion, the press, cinema, radio, television, makes it possible for everyone to participate in human events the world over. 62. At the same time, however, this multiplication and daily extension of forms of association brings with it a multiplicity of restrictive laws and regulations in many departments of human life. As a consequence, it narrows the sphere of a person's freedom of action. The means often used, the methods followed, the atmosphere created, all conspire to make it difficult for a person to think independently of outside influences, to act on his own initiative, exercise his responsibility and express and fulfill his own personality. What then must we conclude? That these increased social relationships necessarily reduce men to the condition of being mere automatons? By no means. 63. For actually this growth in the social life of man is not a product of natural forces working, as it were, by blind impulse. It is, as we saw, the creation of men who are free and autonomous by nature, though they must, of course, recognize, and, in a sense, obey the laws of economic development and social progress, and cannot altogether escape from the pressure of environment. 64. The development of these social relationships, therefore, can and ought to be realized in a way best calculated to promote its inherent advantages and to preclude, or at least diminish, its attendant disadvantages. 65. To this end, a sane view of the common good must be present and operative in men, invested with public authority. They must take account of all those social conditions which favor the full development of human personality. Moreover, we consider it altogether vital that the numerous intermediary bodies and corporate enterprises, which are, so to say, the main vehicle of this social growth, be really autonomous, and loyally collaborate in pursuit of their own specific interests and those of the common good. For these groups must themselves necessarily present the form and substance of a true community, and this will only be the case if they treat their individual members as human persons, and encourage them to take an active part in the ordering of their lives. 66. As these mutual ties binding the men of our age one to the other grow and develop, governments will the more easily achieve a right order the more they succeed in striking a balance between the autonomous and active collaboration of individuals and groups, and the timely coordination and encouragement by the state of these private undertakings. 67. So long as social relationships do in fact adhere to these principles within the framework of the moral order, their extension does not necessarily mean that individual citizens will be gravely discriminated against or excessively burdened. On the contrary, we can hope that they will help him to develop and perfect his own personal talents, and lead to that organic reconstruction of society which our predecessor Pius XI advocated in his encyclical Quadragesimo Anno as the indispensable prerequisite for the fulfillment of the rights and obligations of social life. 26. 68. We are filled with an overwhelming sadness when we contemplate the sorry spectacle of millions of workers in many lands and entire continents condemned through the inadequacy of their wages to live with their families in utterly subhuman conditions. This is probably due to the fact that the process of industrialization in these countries is only in its initial stages, or still not sufficiently developed. 69. Nevertheless, in some of these lands the enormous wealth, the unbridled luxury of the privileged few stands in violent offensive contrast to the utter poverty of the vast majority. In some parts of the world men are being subjected to inhuman privations, so that the output of the national economy can be increased at a rate of acceleration beyond what would be possible if regard were had to social justice and equity. And in other countries a notable percentage of income is absorbed in building up an ill-conceived national prestige, and vast sums are spent on armaments. 70. In economically developed countries, relatively unimportant services, and services of doubtful value, frequently carry a disproportionately high rate of remuneration, while the diligent and profitable work of whole classes of honest hard-working men gets scant reward. Their rate of pay is quite inadequate to meet the basic needs of life. It in no way corresponds to the contribution they make to the good of the community, to the profits of the company for which they work, and to the general national economy. 71. We therefore consider it our duty to reaffirm that the remuneration of work is not something that can be left to the laws of the marketplace, nor should it be a decision left to the will of the more powerful. It must be determined in accordance with justice and equity, which means that workers must be paid a wage which allows them to live a truly human life and to fulfill their family obligations in a worthy manner. Other factors too enter into the assessment of a just wage, namely, the effective contribution which each individual makes to the economic effort, the financial state of the company for which he works, the requirements of the general good of the particular country, having regard especially to the repercussions on the overall employment of the working force in the country as a whole, and finally the requirements of the common good of the universal family of nations of every kind, both large and small. 72. The above principles are valid always and everywhere. So much is clear. But their degree of applicability to concrete cases cannot be determined without reference to the quantity and quality of available resources, and these can, and in fact do, vary from country to country, and even from time to time within the same country. 73. In view of the rapid expansion of national economies, particularly since the war, there is one very important social principle to which we would draw your attention. It is this: economic progress must be accompanied by a corresponding social progress, so that all classes of citizens can participate in the increased productivity. The utmost vigilance and effort is needed to ensure that social inequalities, so far from increasing, are reduced to a minimum. 74. As our predecessor Pius XII observed with evident justification, likewise the national economy, as it is the product of the men who work together in the community of the state, has no other end than to secure without interruption the material conditions in which the individual life of the citizens may fully develop. Where this is secured in a permanent way, a people will be, in a true sense, economically rich, because the general well-being, and consequently the personal right of all to the use of worldly goods, is thus actuated in conformity with the purpose, willed by the Creator. 27. From this it follows, that the economic prosperity of a nation is not so much its total assets in terms of wealth and property, as the equitable division and distribution of this wealth. This it is which guarantees the personal development of the members of society, which is the true goal of a nation's economy. 75. We must notice in this connection the system of self-financing adopted in many countries by large, or comparatively large firms. Because these companies are financing replacement and plant expansion out of their own profits, they grow at a very rapid rate. In such cases we believe that the workers should be allocated shares in the firms for which they work, especially when they are paid no more than a minimum wage. 76. We should recall here the principle enunciated by Pius XI in Quadragesimo Anno. It is entirely false to ascribe to the property alone, or to the work alone, whatever has been obtained through the combined effort of both, and it is wholly unjust for either, denying the efficacy of the other, to arrogate to itself whatever has been produced. 28. 77. Experience suggests many ways in which the demands of justice can be satisfied. Not to mention other ways, it is especially desirable today that workers gradually come to share in the ownership of their company, by ways and in the manner that seem most suitable. For today, even more than in the time of our predecessor, every effort must be made that at least in future a just share only of the fruits of production be permitted to accumulate in the hands of the wealthy, and that an ample sufficiency be supplied to the workers. 29. 78. But a further point needs emphasizing. Any adjustment between wages and profits must take into account the demands of the common good of the particular country, and of the whole human family. 79. What are these demands? On the national level they include, employment of the greatest possible number of workers, care lest privileged classes arise, even among the workers, maintenance of equilibrium between wages and prices, the need to make goods and services accessible to the greatest number, elimination, or at least the restriction, of inequalities in the various branches of the economy, that is, between agriculture, industry and services, creation of it. There should be the possibility of moderating the contract of work by one of partnership. 30. 85. Hence the craftsman's business and that of the family farm, as well as the cooperative enterprise which aims at the completion and perfection of both these concerns, all these are to be safeguarded and encouraged in harmony with the common good and technical progress. 86. We shall return shortly to the question of the family farm. Here we consider it appropriate to say something about artisan and cooperative enterprises. 87. First of all, it is necessary to emphasize that, if these two kinds of undertaking are to thrive and prosper, they must be prepared constantly to adjust their productive equipment and their productive methods to meet new situations created by the advance of science and technology and the changing demands and preferences of the consumer. This adaptation must be effected principally by the workers themselves and the members of the cooperatives. 88. Both these groups, therefore, need a thoroughgoing technical and general education, and should have their own professional organizations. It is equally important that the government take the proper steps regarding their training, taxation, credit, social security and insurance. 89. Furthermore, these two categories of citizens, craftsmen and members of cooperatives, are fully entitled to these watchful measures of the state, for they are upholding true human values and contributing to the advance of civilization. 90. We therefore paternally invite our beloved sons, craftsmen and members of cooperatives throughout the world, to realize the greatness of this task which is theirs in the state. By the force of their example they are helping to keep alive in their own community a true sense of responsibility, a spirit of cooperation, and the constant desire to create new and original work of outstanding merit. 91. We, no less than our predecessors, are convinced that employees are justified in wishing to participate in the activity of the industrial concern for which they work. It is not, of course, possible to lay down hard and fast rules regarding the manner of such participation, for this must depend upon prevailing conditions, which vary from firm to firm, and are frequently subject to rapid and substantial alteration. But we have no doubt as to the need for giving workers an active part in the business of the company for which they work, be it a private or a public one. Every effort must be made to ensure that the enterprise is indeed a true human community, concerned about the needs, the activities and the standing of each of its members. 92. This demands that the relations between management and employees reflect understanding, appreciation and goodwill on both sides. It demands too, that all parties cooperate actively and loyally in the common enterprise, not so much for what they can get out of it for themselves, but as discharging a duty, and rendering a service to their fellow men. All this implies that the workers have their say in, and make their own contribution to, the efficient running and development of the enterprise. As Pius XII remarked, the economic and social function which every man aspires to fulfill demands that the carrying on of the activity of each one is not completely subjected to the other's. 31. Obviously, any firm which is concerned for the human dignity of its workers must also maintain a necessary and efficient unity of direction. But it must not treat those employees who spend their days in service with the firm as though they were mere cogs in the machinery, denying them any opportunity of expressing their wishes or bringing their experience to bear on the work in hand, and keeping them entirely passive in regard to decisions that regulate their activity. 93. We would observe, finally, that the present demand for workers to have a greater say in the conduct of the firm accords not only with man's nature, but also with recent progress in the economic, social, and political spheres. 94. For although many unjust and inhuman economic and social imbalances still exist in our day, and there are still many errors affecting the activity, aims, structure, and operation of economies the world over, it is an undeniable fact that, thanks to the driving impulse of scientific and technical advance, productive systems are today rapidly becoming more modernized and efficient, more so than ever before. Hence a greater technical skill is required of the workers, and more exacting professional qualifications. Which means that they must be given more assistance, and more free time in which to complete their vocational training as well as to carry out more fittingly their cultural, moral and religious education. 95. As a further consequence, the modern youth is enabled to devote a longer time to his basic schooling in the arts and sciences. 96. All this serves to create an environment in which workers are encouraged to assume greater responsibility in their own sphere of employment. In politics too, it is of no small consequence that citizens are becoming daily more aware of their responsibility for furthering the common good in all spheres of life. 97. In modern times we have seen an extensive increase in the number of workers' associations, and their general recognition in the juridical codes of single states, and on the international level. Members are no longer recruited in order to agitate, but rather to cooperate, principally by the method of collective bargaining. But it is worthwhile stressing here how timely and imperative it is that workers be given the opportunity to exert their influence throughout the state, and not just within the limits of their own spheres of employment. 98. The reason for this is that the individual productive concerns, regardless of their size, efficiency, and importance in the state, form but a part, an integral part, of a nation's entire economic and social life, upon which their own prosperity must depend. 99. Hence it is not the decisions made within the individual productive units which have the greatest bearing on the economy, but those made by public authorities, and by institutions which tackle the various economic problems on a national or international basis. It is therefore very appropriate, or even necessary, that these public authorities and institutions bring the workers into their discussions, and those who represent the rights, demands, and aspirations of the workingmen, and not confine their deliberations to those who merely represent the interests of management. 100. It is our prerogative to be a father, and there is a special place in our thoughts and in our heart for those professional groups and Christian associations of workers which exist and operate in so many parts of the world. We know the nature and extent of the difficulties under which these dearest sons of ours are laboring, as they strive continually and effectually to promote in their own countries and throughout the world the material and moral interests of the working people. 101. They are fully deserving of our praise. The importance of their work must be gauged not merely by its immediate and obvious results, but also by its effect on the working world as a whole, where it helps to spread sound principles of action and the wholesome influence of the Christian religion. 102. We wish further to praise those dear sons of ours who in a true Christian spirit collaborate with other professional groups and workers' associations which respect the natural law and the freedom of conscience of their members. 103. We must also express here our heartfelt appreciation of the work that is being done by the International Labour Organization, popularly known in various countries as the OIL or ILOE or OIT. For many years now it has been making an effective and valued contribution to the establishment in the world of an economics and social order marked by injustice and humanity, an order which recognizes and safeguards the lawful rights of the workingman. 104. It is well known that in recent years in the larger industrial concerns distinction has been growing between the ownership of productive goods and the responsibility of company managers. This has created considerable problems for public authorities, whose duty it is to see that the aims pursued by the leaders of the principal organizations, especially those which have an important part to play in the national economy, do not conflict in any way with the interests of the common good. Experience shows that these problems arise whether the capital which makes possible these vast undertakings belongs to private citizens or to public corporations. 105. It is also true that more and more people today, through belonging to insurance groups and systems of social security, find that they can face the future with confidence, the sort of confidence which formerly resulted from their possession of a certain amount of property. 106. And another thing happening today is that people are aiming at proficiency in their trade or profession, rather than the acquisition of private property. They think more highly of an income which derives from capital and their rights have capital. 107. And this is as it should be. Work, which is the immediate expression of a human personality, must always be rated higher than the possession of external goods which of their very nature are merely instrumental. This view of work is certainly an indication of an advance that has been made in our civilization. 108. What, then, of the social and economic principle so vigorously asserted and defended by our predecessors, man's natural right to own private property, including productive goods? Is this no longer operative today, or has it lost some of its validity in view of the economic conditions we have described above? This is the doubt that has arisen in many minds. 109. There is no reason for such a doubt to persist. The right of private ownership of goods, including productive goods, has permanent validity. It is part of the natural order, which teaches that the individual is prior to society and society must be ordered to the good of the individual. Moreover, it would be quite useless to insist on free and personal initiative in the economic field, while at the same time withdrawing man's right to dispose freely of the means indispensable to the achievement of such initiative. Further, history and experience testify that in those political regimes which do not recognize the rights of private ownership of goods, productive included, the exercise of freedom in almost every other direction is suppressed or stifled. This suggests, surely, that the exercise of freedom finds its guarantee and incentive in the right of ownership. 110. This explains why social and political movements for the harmonizing of justice and freedom in society, though until recently opposed to the private ownership of productive goods, are today reconsidering their position in the light of a clearer understanding of social history, and are in fact now declaring themselves in favor of this right. 111. Accordingly, we make our own the directive of our predecessor Pius XII, In defending the principle of private ownership, the Church is striving after an important ethico-social end. She does not intend merely to uphold the present condition of things, as if it were an expression of the divine will, or to protect on principle the rich and plutocrats against the poor and indigent. The Church aims rather at securing that the institution of private property be such as it should be according to the plan of the divine wisdom and the dispositions of nature. 32. Hence private ownership must be considered as a guarantee of the essential freedom of the individual, and at the same time an indispensable element in a true social order. 112. Moreover, in recent years, as we have seen, the productive efficiency of many national economies has been increasing rapidly. Justice and fairness demand, therefore, that, within the limits of the common good, wages too shall increase. This means that workers are able to save more, and thus acquire a certain amount of property of their own. In view of this, it is strange that the innate character of right, which derives its force and validity from the fruitfulness of work, should ever be called in question. A right which constitutes so efficacious a means of asserting one's personality, and exercising responsibility in every field, and an element of solidity and security for family life, and of greater peace and prosperity in the state. 113. But it is not enough to assert that the right to own private property and the means of production is inherent in human nature.